From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is holding his first campaign rally of the year in El Paso, Texas tonight to make another pitch for his version of a border wall, the main stumbling block to a deal that would avoid another government shutdown this coming weekend. But you've probably been hearing El Paso city officials and residents pushing back on Trump's claim that the city was dangerous, violent, only became safer after a border wall was put up there about 10 years ago. El Paso Mayor DeMargo, a Republican, spoke today with Morning Edition.
We were one of the safest cities before the fence went up. You go back to 2005, we were ranked as one of the top safest cities.
And a possible challenger to President Trump's presidency will also be rallying tonight in El Paso, former Congressman and El Paso native Beto O'Rourke. Mallory Falk is covering the story for KRWG in Las Cruces, New Mexico, about an hour away. She is in El Paso today, though. Mallory, tell us about what seems like a complete disconnect. The El Paso Times says the president is repeating inaccurate claims made by the Texas Attorney General.
Yeah, so it appears this claim originated back when President Trump visited Texas in early January, and the Attorney General Ken Paxton made the claim that El Paso had been one of the nation's most violent cities, but that the violent crime rate dropped dramatically after the border fencing was built here. But FBI's crime statistics don't bear this out. According to those statistics, violent crime steadily fell in El Paso after a peak in 1993 and was very low by the time the fencing was constructed, and in fact, has started to rise a slight bit since that fencing was built.
Oh, that's the complete opposite. And this isn't the first time this has happened. In 2010, the governor, Rick Perry, wrongly announced that car bombs were going off in El Paso. They were not. They were going off a good deal away in Juarez, Mexico. And, you know, we're reading that people there, you know, like the head of the police, they travel to visit relatives who ask, you know, do you wear bulletproof vests? Is there nothing but dirt roads there? The image that's painted of El Paso doesn't conform with the reality. Tell us more about what people there are saying.
Yeah, during the State of the Union, folks on the ground here were sending out sort of joking tweets about the real dangers in El Paso are dehydration or touching your steering wheel when it's too hot in the summer. And El Paso is consistently ranked one of the safest cities in the U.S. And so there really does seem to be this disconnect between people's lived experience on the ground here, where people feel extremely safe. If anything, it's boring compared to sort of this national image of a lawless, dangerous city.
Well, also, this is a city that very much connects with Mexico. There's a bridge. People go back and forth.
Exactly, yes. And many people in El Paso have family just across the border in Juarez and routinely cross back and forth. There are people who live in one city and work or go to school in the other. And so it is very fluid, this travel across the border.
Well, and in addition to the president coming, you have Beto O'Rourke, again, a candidate for senator. He lost just narrowly to Ted Cruz, a native of El Paso. He's been saying that he thinks the president coming and demonizing the city might be a good thing, you know, for those who don't believe that a wall would be effective. He's going to be joining a celebration of El Paso March today. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so dozens of local organizations are organizing this march, and the goal is to try to share what they're calling the truth about the city, the real story of El Paso, as a community that's safe, as a community that's vibrant, as a community where many people have ties on both sides of the border. And O'Rourke is going to speak at the exact moment that Trump is addressing people who have gathered Make America Great Again rally.
So the president will be holding this rally. Presumably his people on the ground know that he can fill that coliseum. And while this is a blue spot in a red state, you know, the president did get thousands of votes in this area. There have been recent arrests of large groups of Central American immigrants crossing the border. There have been large drug seizures at the port of entry. This is the legal port of entry where most of the large drug hauls come through. That has nothing to do with a wall, but are there people there speaking in defense of the president?
There are people who are speaking in defense of increasing border security, who are talking about remote stretches of southern New Mexico where more asylum seekers are crossing now that it's more difficult for folks to cross at some of these larger ports of entry in El Paso with new restrictions on asylum seekers. And so there is a call for more security along that section of the border, and also a call for more folks stationed at these ports of entry so that they can deal with the influx of both illegal narcotics that are coming through and also asylum seekers who are coming in.
That's Mallory Falk of KRWG Radio. She is in El Paso ahead of President Trump's rally tonight and another rally from residents there called A Celebration of El Paso. Mallory, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there are now less than 50 days to go before the UK is set to leave the European Union, and Prime Minister Theresa May is still trying to cobble together support for her plan for a smooth exit. Today, May's Brexit Secretary Steve Barclay is meeting with the EU's Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier to talk about possible changes to May's Brexit deal. Joining us now is the BBC's Adam Fleming in Brussels. And Adam, first of all, what exactly is Michel Barnier saying today? Is there any room for renegotiating between the UK and the EU at this point?
There is room for renegotiation, but not where the UK wants it to be. What the UK wants is changes to what's known as the withdrawal agreement, which is a 585-page legal treaty, which basically settles the terms of the divorce. It includes the incredibly controversial backstop, which is the policy for avoiding checks on the Irish border if there's no trade deal between the two sides that solves that problem further down the line. That is what the UK wants changes to. The EU says, nope, that's done. We've had those negotiations. That document is finished. You've got to live with it. Where the EU is prepared to make some changes and be a bit creative is another document known as the Political Declaration, which sketches out the shape of the future relationship which will be negotiated after Brexit Day. The problem for British members of Parliament is that second document, the Political Declaration, is not a legally binding treaty. Mm-hmm. It's a set of promises. And so they say they're promises that sometimes aren't really worth the paper they're written on. So that's why the British government wants something a bit stronger, a bit tougher.
Okay, so it is all very confusing. It seems like it gets more confusing by the day. But does it lead you to believe that there is going to be some extension of this March 29th deadline, that they really have not gotten their ducks in the row yet?
There's a growing sense here in Brussels that there will be more time needed. But that's still speculation because the UK hasn't asked for that. And it is absolutely not the British Prime Minister Theresa May's policy to change the date of Brexit. What people here in Brussels worry about is the knock-on effects, because we have got elections across the whole of Europe for the European Parliament at the end of May. Hmm. And so now there are lots of questions about, well, if you extend the Brexit talks beyond May, does the UK have to take part in these elections? How would elections in the UK feel for a European Parliament that the UK could potentially be leaving a few weeks later? Also, what if the elections don't take place? Is the UK then breaking EU law? Because it would still be a member of the EU at that point. And you've got some very smart, creative lawyers scratching their heads trying to work out a way around that.
I want to ask you about one more thing. This is something that the European Council President Donald Tusk said last week. He was speaking after talks with the Irish Prime Minister.
By the way, I've been wondering what that special place in hell looks like for those who promoted Brexit without even a sketch of a plan how to carry it safely.
Special place in hell, he says, for those who promoted Brexit without even a sketch of a plan of how to carry it out safely. How are those comments going over?
I mean, this is where my professionalism deserts me, because I was in the room where he said that, and I still kind of get goosebumps when I hear it being played, even though I've heard it about 100 times, because it was such undiplomatic language. Because even in this process where tempers have become a bit frayed, people have still tried to use diplomatic language, but that was absolutely not diplomatic. It was quite an amazing outburst. The fact is, though, it reflects what Donald Tusk has thought for quite some time. And actually, whenever you ask other EU leaders and other EU politicians, what do you think about the people that ran the successful Leave campaign in the UK referendum? And they have said sort of similar things in the past. What's interesting, I just watched a press conference with the Luxembourgish Prime Minister, not exactly a household name, but mm-hmm. he does have a good turn of phrase, and he was laying into the Brexiteers. So Donald Tusk's comments last week have definitely opened the floodgates for other senior EU figures to now be much more brutal about how they feel about the people that they blame for this. Although you'll notice everyone is actually very careful to not blame the individual voters, the members of the public mm-hmm. who voted to leave. This is about the people who ran the campaigns and the politicians that they feel were perhaps not entirely truthful in the campaign in 2016.
Adam, if you care to make a guess right now, what is your best guess of what's going to happen?
I hate having to make guesses, so I'm going to give you a very politician's answer. What Theresa May's strategy, we think, is that she is using the clock as her best friend, and that you'll have British parliamentarians at the moment who are opposed to the deal, but that's with 5.5 weeks to go. If there is only a week to go or 5.5 hours to go, will they be so opposed then? Or will they see the prospect of there being no deal and what that could cause, mm-hmm. the damage it could cause to the UK economy? Will that then suddenly make them a bit more positive about the deal? That's her strategy, we think. And we'll find out in a few weeks, won't we?
That's the BBC's Adam Fleming in Brussels. Adam, thank you.
You're very welcome. Cheers.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for a special blues edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. My mother's child gonna be the greatest man alive. Yes, I love you. And I don't care what you do. Boom, 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 boom. I'm gonna shoot you right down. Joining us now from Boulder, Colorado, is Carrie Wolfson, an award-winning blues host whose show Blues from the Red Rooster Lounge has attracted a cult following over the years. Carrie, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, tell me this about the blues, because I've always noticed that the blues, for some reason, makes everybody who's listening to the blues not blue, but happy, usually. So how does that make sense?
Right. It's a way of getting all that stuff out of your system.
Uh-huh.
Is the best way that I can put it. Okay. It's cathartic.
Okay, well, let's get to one of the ones you wanted us to hear. This is B.B. King, the great B.B. King. This is called Gambler's Blues. Now, I feel like you don't have to know that much about the blues to know about B.B. King. How did he emerge to be one of the greats?
Just by being amazing and prolific. He came out of Mississippi, Indianola, Mississippi, and went to Memphis, Tennessee, where he was a DJ on a radio station in Memphis. And he was so terrific that he just became really popular for that. And went on to record thousands upon thousands of songs. If you listen to that particular song, to me, that guitar solo right there, which is starts the song off, it's just epitomal of what B.B. King is all about. He's got soulful vocals, obviously, but that guitar playing just gives me chills. I've heard that song probably 100 times and or more. And it gives me chills every time I listen to it.
And you can hear that blues slide there, which really makes the blues sound like the blues.
Well, it's not a slide guitar, but it's the way that it's played, mm-hmm. that electric sound. This was recorded live in a Chicago nightclub in 1966. And he was just totally on top of his game at that point and still went on, you know, for another 50 years or so.
Okay, the next one that you brought us is Dark Was the Night, Cold Was the Ground. This is by Blind Willie Johnson, who went blind when his stepmother accidentally threw lye on him when he was a boy. Let's listen.
Oh,
So if there are aliens out there, they may actually know this song because this was sent in 1977 on the Voyager probe into space by NASA so that if aliens ever found it, it would convey something profound about the human condition. By the way, Blind Willie Johnson was born in 1897, so this is very old.
Yeah, this was recorded in 1927. Mm-hmm. And I certainly hope that this is what aliens find out about us before they learn what's going on today, because this is one of the deepest pieces of music you're ever going to hear. I've taught for a number of years at a music and arts camp in Maryland called Common Ground on the Hill, and some friends of mine, musician friends of mine, were in a very contentious discussion in one of their classes. And they asked me to come in right before that class started, and I played this song for them, and it just, like, brought everybody down to a certain level of wowness and deepness, because this song, it's pretty heavy.
Okay, the next one that you wanted us to hear is called Even Now. This is by Johnny Adams.
You say there's no use trying, turning stones that you can't find. Even now I still love you. Sometimes I wonder how.
Johnny Adams from New Orleans. He was known as the Tan Canary.
He had such incredible vocal range and vocal chops. You don't hear it right there, but he could go off into a falsetto from... And does later on in that song. Mm-hmm. So he had terrific vocal range. Very, very dapper gentleman. He recorded this when he knew he was dying of cancer. It's from his very last album. And it was written by two Louisiana songwriters, Buddy Flett and David Egan. David also passed away from cancer a couple of years ago. And I first heard it on an album by the Kate Brothers. And when this one came out, it just floored me. Mm.
Well, let's take a listen here to the falsetto part of the song.
We're even now. Even. We're even now.
All right, Carrie. Well, the next one you wanted us to hear is The Messiah Will Come Again. This is by Roy Buchanan. It starts off with a monologue where Buchanan says he's going to retell the story of Jesus his own way before launching into this. Does sound like his guitar is crying.
Totally. I find a very strong connection between this and Blind Willie Johnson. Blind Willie Johnson was really more of a gospel singer than a blues singer, and this is more of a spiritual than a blues, and yet he makes it into everything that you could possibly make it into. I first heard this album back in the late 1960s, I think, and it was on a self-released disc that came in a burlap bag. Mm. It's still known as the Burlap Bag album. Recorded at a roadhouse in Hyattsville, Maryland. I think they had a microphone hanging from the ceiling or something to record this. He's done it a lot of different times and different ways, but this is the version that really speaks to me.
I have to say, this is the kind of thing that and this is what I love about the blues when it's really great, is you could just sit there and get lost in this for many, many minutes and have a great time.
I've spent many minutes doing
hours,
exactly
probably,
that.
Right?
Hours, right.
Okay,
right.
We have time for one more here, and this is called Reap What You Sow. It's by Otis Rush.
Just one thing, baby. Child, before you go, there's gonna be judgment in the morning, baby. There's gonna be judgment in the morning, baby. There's gonna be judgment in the morning. Yes, baby. You're gonna reap for what you sow.
Okay, tell us about this one, and with the knowledge that you saved the best for last.
Well, yeah. This was when I did a collection of 111 great blues and whatever songs. This was number one, mainly because it was the song that at that time I had played the most on my radio show. And I don't repeat songs very often, but this one, keep coming back to it. It was written by Paul Butterfield, Mike Bloomfield, and Nick Gravenitis, and Bloomfield produced it. My late friend George Myers, who founded and owned the Grand Emporium nightclub in Kansas City, once told me that his ultimate musical set would be 9 Otis Rush songs in a row, each one more depressing than the last.
Okay. Now
he's great at it, though. I mean, Otis just passed away recently, and he was a masterful guitar player, and as you can tell, had a lot of soul in his voice.
That is Kerry Wolfson, who is a blues host. His show is Blues from the Red Rooster Lounge. Kerry, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, you're welcome.
And you can find all of our DJ session picks on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
Don't be surprised if your tax refund is a little lighter this year. According to early data from the IRS, the average refund is $1,865, down from $2,035 last year. It's an 8% drop, but already the hashtag GOP tax scam is cropping up on Twitter as people tweet their frustration. For more, let's go to Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
Okay, so this data is only from the first week of tax filings. It could change, but why do the refunds seem to be lower this year?
Well, I think that a lot of people did not realize that their paychecks were a little bit fatter throughout 2018. So the withholding had been adjusted by many employers, and that resulted usually in many Americans getting slightly higher pay increases, basically your take-home pay. Mm-hmm. But when they went to go file their returns, at least this early crop, they said, oh my God, my refund's lower, so I actually didn't get helped by this tax change. Not the case, of course, because what we know is that your withholding is part of the story. Your refund is the other part of the story. Your whole tax situation might have improved in 2018. It doesn't mean just because you have a lower refund that you paid more in taxes.
But for people who expect a refund every year, it's like another paycheck, basically. You count on it being there, and when it's not as big as you thought, even if you've been getting more money all year, you're not going to be thankful for it.
That's so true. And I think that that's one of the problems. You know, we had some studies that were out, one released by NerdWallet, that found that more than a quarter of Americans are unsure of what changed with the passage of the tax cut bill, and almost half don't understand how it affects their tax bracket. And some of those people are going to have a bit of a rude awakening if they file and see lower refund amounts. That said, there are a lot of analysts and economists who believe that this is probably just the early information and that many more people will be getting big refunds.
Now, let's talk about early filing, because that's down too. Just 10% of taxpayers have filed so far. That is down 12% compared to last year.
Yeah, and I think that this is probably due to the uncertainty, because when we are fearful, when we are confused, what do? We stick our heads in the sand. Don't be so afraid, though. I mean, I think that the most important thing to remember is the sooner you file, the sooner you can actually adjust your withholding right now for 2019. So that may be a course correction that a lot of taxpayers have to make.
Did the government shutdown have a big effect on how quickly the IRS can process these returns?
Not so far. I mean, it does not look like that at all. And it may just be that some people said, well, the government was shut down, I'll wait a little bit till things settle down. So far, so good.
So for the people who are listening right now who haven't even started the process yet, your advice, Jill, would be what?
Well, first of all, you've got to get that old tax return from last year out. Just use it as a quick guide. Now, things may have changed. I also should note that using software is going to be your best bet. The IRS provides amazing software. It's called the IRS Free File. And for people who earn less than $66,000, it's there for you. Do make adjustments. Get through the process. You will feel so virtuous for having done your taxes. Trust me. Oh, wait, I haven't done it yet. But I plan to be virtuous.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks, Jill.
Thank you.
Are you inadvertently participating in the theft of artwork? You might be. Craftspeople, artists, sell their work on platforms like Etsy or on Instagram, but thieves are stealing the pictures of the product, posting them on websites like Amazon, then mass-producing and selling lesser-quality reproductions. Book illustrator and artist Susie Garmani knows this all too well. She's the founder of Boy Girl Party. She sells over 300 products based on her children's book illustrations, everything from stationery to jewelry, all handmade. But now she's seeing others purporting to sell it using pictures of her products. And she's not the only one. This is happening to other artists who are fighting unauthorized use of their work and spending hours filing takedown requests on Amazon. Susie joins us from her home in San Diego. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So tell us about this problem that is huge. Your company, Boy Girl Party, founded in 2002, one of the first sellers on Etsy when they started in 2005. So tell me about your things that are yours that are on the site.
I have long developed this shop that originally it was really liberating to be able to come up with my own product ideas and to create my own products from scratch. But I seem to spend just as much time now chasing around to make sure that they're not being misused and stolen by other sellers. So it's interesting because what was sort of initially, you know, a cottage industry where it was really just a way for me to connect with fans or to connect with people that wanted to support an independent artist has become something that it seems like other companies turn to steal from.
In your case, you're a children's author, your artwork is sold on Etsy or your website, but you start seeing your work, you know, being sold by other people. First of all, what does that feel like?
It's incredibly violating. You know, in one of the listings of my stolen work, the seller said that they were me. They said artwork by me, Susie Garamani. And I can only imagine the sort of the embarrassment and the shame that customers must feel when they get something that's so visibly counterfeit. It's on par with other types of theft, except that in many cases, I have personal history attached to what I've made. And then when you see it just depersonalized and taken out of context and just being sold by some random seller, it sort of feels like, what is the point of doing anything at all? So it's very demoralizing.
Oh, I'm sure. And we want to clarify, it's often not the item. It's a picture of the item that they've stolen. They've taken the picture of your item, but they're selling, you know, a crappy version. And you can see this when people leave comments. They say, this is garbage. So it's purported to be your work on the page. that people are commenting about saying it's garbage, but it's not really your work that they're getting.
Right. It's kind of a nightmare when you see everything that you've worked toward, everything that I've worked toward, from making the artwork to making an actual product, sort of totally turned around and ruined. And I really worry that people aren't aware that this is happening, or they're buying something with the best of intentions of supporting an artist, and really what they're supporting is this, you know, sort of messed up black market situation.
BuzzFeed wrote about this. There's tons of artists like yourself who are spending all this time, and, you know, when you calculate the cost to you of the hours that you're spending to try to get this stuff taken down, that's hard to understand. Amazon has an infringement claims public notice portal that you can go to say that somebody's infringing on, you know, your work. But what we're hearing is that that doesn't work. Why? Why can't you just call up Amazon and say, oh, that's mine, make them take it down?
Yeah, I'm not really sure why there's this disconnect with how they process these infringements, because I know that they know what's happening too. They run this large third-party marketplace. Anyone can sell on Amazon, so it's sort of seems like they should have come up with a solution by now. But instead, they have this extremely cumbersome platform that they're supposed to adhere to U.S. copyright laws and the DMCA. They're supposed to take down infringing material when they're notified about it. But instead, they sort of act as an intermediary and try to filter the complaints. And, you know, I've gotten response that say things like, we can't verify your identity, or we can't verify you're the rights owner, when that's not really part of the complaint procedure. They're supposed to act as a third party removing material, not trying to snuff out if the complaint is valid. So they're inadvertently refusing tons of legitimate complaints from artists like me, because they're trying to police their own complaint system instead of just adhering to takedown procedures. It's maddening because, you know, they're saying things like they can't verify the identity of the rights holder, when my name as the rights holder is in the stolen listing because the person is saying that they are me. It feels like Catch-22 or something. Mm-hmm. It feels like I'm in some kind of strange satire of, you know, isn't anyone actually thinking about what this is, you know, and why don't they want their marketplace to have the integrity that literally the whole world wants them to have? Everybody wants them to have more integrity, not less.
Well, and try returning a third-party vendor item that you've bought to Amazon. Forget about it. But anyway, in 2017, a federal appeals court decided that Amazon, because it's a provider of services, is not the seller. And so the third-party seller is responsible for the uploaded content. And this, of course, gives them less, you know, liability and responsibility. But this also the attitude of people. I was surprised to read, well, maybe not surprised to read, in BuzzFeed's reporting, that another artist, Kim Mills of Rosie's Design Studio, her photo stolen by a seller named Wu Zhongguan, and many of these sellers seem to be in countries other than the U.S., and he said to her, no, I found him on the internet. What's on the internet belongs to everybody. There is that sense that the internet is free and open in the Wild West, and it doesn't belong to you, that photo. Somebody can take it.
I think that's a misperception that's happening internationally. And, you know, in this case, this is a seller who also stole my work, who I believe is located overseas. But I experienced this problem with sellers in the U.S. as well that use print-on-demand companies, and they're just looking for an image to upload and then put on any variety of products like, you know, phone cases and T-shirts and things like that. They have the means to manufacture with the touch of a button without actually having to put in the effort that I put into making my products. All they need is the image. So they just use what they find elsewhere. And no one's really doing anything to police this mass infringement that's happening on these platforms where anybody can open up a store.
Yeah. Well, meantime, there is a case before the Supreme Court that may make it easier to sue for infringement. But putting that aside, there's supposed to be all sorts of technology where you can plug in, let's say, a picture of your work and see if it shows up somewhere else. How's that going?
Well, it's not an option through Amazon if you're trying to file a complaint about your artwork. However, it's strange to me that they do enable that feature for buyers. If you're in a store and you open up your Amazon app and take a picture of an item in a physical store, they'll show you the matching items on Amazon. So it sort of seems like they use the technology for their benefit when it enables people to spend money, but they're not going to use that exact same technology that they have access to when it enables them to comply with law. So I kind of don't understand it myself, why they haven't found the solutions.
Well, I'm looking at your glass owl necklace. Very, very pretty. And I'm just, you know, wondering, in this day and age, and by the way, we'll link people at hearnow.org, and that will be really her. That will be really Susie Garamani and Boy Girl Party when you hit that link. But can you even afford not to use these online services?
I mean, for me, it's how I make a living as an artist. I think as an artist, the internet is one of the greatest tools you can have to reach people that aren't in your immediate demographic. Like, San Diego is not the biggest art-buying audience, but there are people all over the world who are looking for something that is made by an artist or something that expresses their identities or their personalities. So it's one of the most important tools you can have as an artist. It's just that the problems that come with it are starting to overwhelm its benefits. So if I want to continue having, you know, making a living as an independent artist, I need to be able to use these tools, but I also need to be able to have the time to make my work and not spend all my time battling legal issues, which is right now, that's what I spend most of my time doing. And it's become a real roadblock to being a creative person in the world.
Susie Garamani, illustrator, artist based in San Diego, founder of Boy Girl Party. We'll link you again at hearnow.org. Susie, best of luck to you and all the other artists. I mean, there's thousands of you. Best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
And we reached out to Amazon for a response. Haven't heard back, but hope to. Meantime, we'd love to hear from you. hearnow.org.
The man behind the term freedom fries has died. Longtime Congressman Walter Jones of North Carolina died yesterday on his 76th birthday. In 2003, he suggested renaming French fries to freedom fries to protest France's opposition to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. But observers say Jones's long career in public office, which spanned both parties, exemplified moderation and independence. Jeff Tiberi of member station WUNC has this remembrance.
In a swamp filled with vitriol, Walter Jones was once voted the nicest member of Congress, armed with an Eastern North Carolina brogue and a passion for his constituents.
I just would rather for to have my independence and not be beholden to leadership. My responsibility and my obligation is to the people of the 3rd District, not to the leadership.
Jones possessed a fierce political autonomy. During a 2017 interview with WUNC, he quoted a former chief of staff to describe his own independence.
When Walter Jones walks to the floor of the House to cast a vote, he'll either vote as a conservative, a populist, or a libertarian. And that probably, depending on the issue, is as good a description. I am independent. I want to do what I think is right for the people of my district. And sometimes I cross party lines for that reason.
He was a proponent of small government, individual liberties, a religious social conservative who also supported an increase to the minimum wage and railed against the proliferating money in political campaigns. Jones broke with leadership and his party as frequently as anyone.
Walter is the epitome of what the founding fathers intended a congressman to be.
Joe Mavretic served with Walter Jones in North Carolina's state legislature. The Democrat first met Jones more than 35 years ago. He refers to his friend as a second cousin, a fellow tobacco kid from the East, and describes Jones as a fair-minded gentleman, regularly willing to compromise.
He votes his conscience. He votes what he believes is in the best interest of his constituents, and he's not afraid to do that. And Walter's political life at the national level is really a case study in what's wrong with Washington today.
The congressman often said if you can't pay for it, you ought not to spend it. He would vote against budgets that were projected to increase the national debt. And Mavretic says Jones was punished by Republican leadership, never receiving committee chairmanships. Before his days in the U.S. House, Jones's nonconforming voice was also heard in Raleigh. In the winter of 1989, Jones and Mavretic set out to deal with a problem in the state house,
which was really a very similar to the problem in the U.S. Congress today. There were a few people who made a lot of members toe the line. Whether you liked it or not, you better vote the way that they signal for you to vote, or you are in big trouble. And Walter knew it, didn't like it, and participated in the coup.
30 years ago this winter, Jones, Mavretic, and 18 other dissenting Democrats successfully hatched a plan to overthrow the Speaker of the State House, a member of their own party. Following 5 terms in the General Assembly, Jones lost a bid for Congress. He then switched parties, won as a Republican in 1994, and has been in the U.S. House ever since. His district includes the Marine Base Camp Lejeune. Military issues were consistently a top priority. And in 2002, a vote on one of his most important issues led to what Jones would later call his biggest mistake. Catawba College political science professor Michael Bitzer.
Something that he agonized over was the vote for the Iraq military authorization. And he came out against it after he had voted for it.
Intelligence used to rationalize the invasion turned out to be flawed. In the years to follow, Jones talked on the House floor about his regret and also the nearly 10,000 letters he signed addressed to families who had lost loved ones in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars.
I do that every weekend so I can be reminded of my mistake of voting to give President Bush the authority to go into Iraq, a war we never had to fight. It was manipulated by those within the administration, and it was never had to be.
Since 1966, for all but 2 years, much of eastern North Carolina has been represented by a Jones in Congress. His father, Walter Sr., was elected to 13 terms. He died while in office. Walter Jr. was also elected to 13 terms, and he, too, passed away while in the U.S. House. For Here and Now, I'm Jeff Tiberi.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.